Oral questions by members.
Leader of the official opposition.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Sydney was an 18-year-old general science student at the University of Victoria, like all 18-year-olds, full of life and promise for the future. Tragically, her bright future was ended by a preventable overdose. And today, her devastated parents are fighting for accountability and changes so other families will not have to endure this agony. In a letter to the Premier, her parents write, and I quote, "Our daughter's death was completely preventable. Systemic failures by both the province of BC and the University of Victoria led directly to Sydney's untimely death," end of quote. So my question to the Premier, how many more young lives will be lost before this government recognizes that his government's approach to this drug crisis is tragically failing and that dramatic changes are necessary and urgently needed to protect our youth?
Premier.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. This is an absolutely horrific situation for Sydney's family, for her friends. The timeline of events is profoundly disturbing. Reconstructed by Sydney's family, they have the 911 call, which they've listened to, which I can't even imagine what that would be like as a parent. I've had a very brief conversation with Sydney's mom, who has been advocating for her daughter, that her daughter's death is not in vain, that it results in reform, and that what their family is going through is not repeated. The Solicitor General will be directing a coroner's inquest, and the point of the coroner's inquest will be to get the answers for Sydney's family, absolutely, to get answers for British Columbians, and to get answers for this place, to make sure that we're doing all we can to prevent every death that we can in this terrible toxic drug crisis that has taken so many lives and damaged so many families. I've stood a number of times here and explained our twin goals: to keep people alive, to make sure that they're able to survive, and to support them in recovery while ensuring safe communities. Sydney's death is horrible. And it is a death that is preceded by thousands of other deaths and affected families and friends. This toxic drug crisis is a public health crisis. It is a tragedy, and it's hard to think of a case that better illustrates that tragedy than the death of such a remarkable young person as Sydney.
Leader of the Official Opposition, supplemental.
Thank you. Mr. Speaker, as the parent of two daughters myself, I know that I speak for all parents that are concerned that more words are not going to be enough. What are needed are changes so that we get different results. I've been talking about this with this premier ever since I've been in the legislature. We are 8 years into what has been called a public health emergency. It was designated as one in 2016, and the response under this premier can best be described as patchwork, half measures, and fatal inconsistencies. Some campuses have accessible naloxone, while others restrict access to business hours, a life-saving measure that is impeded by bureaucracy. In their letter to the premier, Sydney's parents demand mandatory CPR and naloxone training, free and widely available nasal naloxone, improved emergency protocols on campus, and yes, a coroner's inquest, which I'm pleased to see that the Premier, I believe, has committed to at least making sure that that happens. But to the Premier, will the Premier listen to this grieving family and follow through not just on their recommendations, but the call from this opposition, as we've been calling for years, that the solution to this drug crisis also has to include education, Education for our young people so they understand that all drugs are dangerous and drugs can be fatal. Will the Premier at least commit to doing that and protect the next group of young people from not having to go through what Sydney and her family have had to deal with?
Premier.
Thank you, Honourable Speaker. The part of the tragedy of Sydney's death, as I understand it, is that there were security from MUVIC that were in the room as she died that had naloxone, that had naloxone training, and did not deploy that naloxone immediately. There are serious questions that need to be answered about this horrific death, which is why the Solicitor General has directed a coroner's inquest. We are reaching out to university presidents right across the province to make sure that they are doing all they can on their campuses. We have naloxone available for every post-secondary institution. And this is the situation that anyone can imagine. There's a kid in a dorm room with a friend that they trust and like that offers them something and they don't know where it came from. And it ends up in a horrific result that could have been prevented. This is horrific. And we will work with the family to get them the answers that they deserve. And we will ensure that any necessary policy changes are in place to prevent similar deaths.
Member for Prince George Vale-Mount.
Well, thank you very much. And part of the action that is required is to actually remind young British Columbians that there are no safe drugs. The Premier completely avoided committing to talking about that in British Columbia. But my question is to the Minister of Post-Secondary Education. Straight question. Does her ministry oversee and regulate the training of first responders on post-secondary campuses to ensure that they are equipped to handle medical emergencies involving students?
Minister of Mental Health and Addictions.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Honourable Speaker, and thank you to the member for the question. And of course, in this House, we are all grieving with Sydney's family today as a result of her tragic death. And I want to assure the member and all members of this House and everyone in our communities that we are working across all of our post-secondary system, across our health authorities and public health to ensure that we have the appropriate procedures and training in place to ensure that this doesn't happen again, including our education campaign, which is very much exactly that, telling youth that the illicit drug supply is poison. It is contaminated. We've been running that campaign last fall. It's running right now.
Member.
It's going to be. It's
good. Member for Surrey South, control yourself, please. Minister will continue.
This is work that we do across the education system to talk to youth about the dangers of the illicit drug supply right now, and we will continue to do that work, Honourable Speaker.
Prince George Vale-Mount supplemental.
I am sure those words bring little comfort to Sydney's parents and people across British Columbia who are grieving every day. All we hear from this minister is words. Yesterday, the Minister of Post-Secondary Education ran for cover when she had an opportunity to answer these questions. The Minister of Post-Secondary Education declined yesterday to speak with Post Media about how her ministry is safeguarding over 300,000 post-secondary students from overdose crisis. She has not addressed, even today, why naloxone is available and easily accessible in emergency boxes on some campuses, while others restrict access to business hours only. That is her job. That is her responsibility. She should have stood up yesterday and said, I'm taking care of this. I will ensure that this is mandated for every single post-secondary institution. She refused to answer the question, will she do it for Sydney's parents today?
Minister of Post-Secondary Education.
Thank you, Speaker. And I want to echo the Premier's sentiments and pass my condolences and my heart goes out to Sydney's family and to her brother and her friends. This is a tragic incident. We are taking action. I am meeting with the presidents of the post-secondaries to review the policies that are in place so that we can ensure that... So that we can make improvements and ensure that students are kept safe. Naloxone was in the room, Speaker, and unfortunately it was not used in a timely manner, according to what we've heard. There is a review underway with BC Emergency Health Services. The Minister of Public Safety has directed a coroner's inquest to get more answers. We are taking action to make sure that we get answers for Sydney's family and so that we can protect students on our campuses all across this province.
Leader of the Third Party.
Thank you, Honourable Speaker. The Site C Dam is the largest publicly funded infrastructure project in BC's history. The price has doubled since the government came to power. Last time we got an update, it was $16 billion. I'm guessing that, like most things we buy today, we can expect to pay between 18 and 25% more. This project has been plagued by geotechnical problems. It trampled Indigenous rights. It will result in the loss of vast amounts of fertile agricultural land, and the reservoir will be a source of methane emissions. This project has been cloaked in secrecy and obfuscation, and it represents a betrayal of the public's trust. This government promised supporters they would not forge ahead with this boondoggle in 2017, but they did. And while it nears completion, it remains to be seen if it will even be able to produce the promised electricity, because severe drought linked to climate change has significantly restricted electricity production in the Peace region. My question is to the Premier. Does he regret approving Site C, particularly given the huge financial burden it will put on the people of BC, while the energy it generates will go to the climate-destroying fossil fuel industry?
Minister of Energy and Mines.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker, and thank you very much to the Leader of the Green Party for the question. Site C is going to add about 8% of electricity to BC's grid, and with BC Hydro's call for power issued just this spring, another 5% will be added to that grid. This is vital, clean electricity that we need to power homes. We need to power the choices that British Columbians are making as they switch and move away from fossil fuels into BC's clean electricity. The project is an important project that will supply that electricity, Mr. Speaker. But, Mr. Speaker, I want to be very clear. BC Hydro accounts for and plans for drought. The water levels in the reservoirs this year are higher than they were at this time last year. Planning is underway to ensure that British Columbians will always have safe, reliable, clean electricity that we need as part of this global energy transition. Thank you.
Leader of Third Party Supplemental.
Thank you, Honourable Speaker. I really wonder what the people of BC think when we're building a mega dam to provide so-called clean electricity that is really destined to prop up the fossil fuel industry in this province. The flooding of the Peace River Valley for Site C will not just undermine food security, it will impact water security. Drought levels are extreme. Fires are threatening towns, displacing people, smoke and air pollution are harming people's health, but this government acts like it's 1989. For 7 years, there's been no real urgency to respond proactively to the diminishing water in our province. Efforts to get water users licensed were weak and ineffective. The investments to build water tables around the province have been sorely lacking. Meanwhile, trade in water in Alberta has begun. If the members are actually serious about affordability for people in BC, they should think really hard about what it will mean to have supply and demand pricing for fresh water. My question, Honourable Speaker, is to the Premier. How does he square the fact that we're in severe drought with his government being hell-bent on scaling up the water-gobbling fracked gas industry in BC?
Minister of Water, Land and Resource Stewardship.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Thanks for the question. We have been reporting publicly at the beginning of each month our snowpack levels in BC, and they've been raising serious concerns because they are sitting at historical lows. For for those that are aware of that concern, it's because that water is the water we rely on through the summer, spring, summer, and into the fall months. Droughts historically in British Columbia have been very localized and relatively short-term. We have seen with last summer and previous summers, and our expectation is this summer, unfortunately, that droughts are more pervasive and long-term. That's why we've been working very closely with Ministry of Forests and particularly Ministry of Agriculture in standing up more than $100 million for agriculture producers, ranchers across this province to be able to hold water back on the land. We recently announced the Weir in Cowichan, which my friend was at, another example of the many projects that are being lifted up by communities we are trying to support, because we know that we must consider water differently. We must value it and understand its impact on our economy, our culture, particularly wild salmon. And our efforts will continue, Mr. Speaker. And it's efforts that we have to make at all orders of government, with partners from industry, First Nations, and every individual British Columbian, because every water drop counts. Thank you very much.
Member, just a reminder, no electronic equipment during the question period. Leader of the Fourth Party.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. This government's made a lot of noise about hotels that have been purchased for housing. So let's have a look at a couple of these hotels that were purchased. In Prince George, the Knights Inn, which was purchased for $1.1 million, 4 years later was then sold as a part of a housing project for $4.1 million. Nice 400% increase on the project. The individuals involved in this project, Mr. Cotro and Mr. Banipal, were also involved in another project in Prince George. The North Star Inn, which was purchased for $3.25 million, was then sold to BC Housing for $10.5 million. And that's just a mere 4 years for another quick 300% profit. Mr. Speaker, and the same individuals were involved in this deal. My question to you, to the Premier, is this. This not only looks bad, it does not pass the smells test. Will the Premier commit today to doing a forensic audit of BC Housing so that the people of British Columbia know that the money is being spent appropriately and there's nothing inappropriate happening in BC Housing?
Minister of Housing.
Thank you so much, Honourable Chair, and thank you for the member's question. It is correct that we purchased the North Star Inn. It was a important measure to address homelessness, the encampments that we're seeing in Prince George. We've been working closely with local First Nations, with the city, to ensure that not only are we able to open up more spaces, but in some cases acquire buildings that are on the market that are available to get people in. 120 units. Every time a building is purchased, it follows the same protocols that were in place when that member was in the BC Liberal government. The procedures are, there's appraisals done, there's validation done of the price compared to what's in the market. But I think the member would agree, because he represents some of the region, that it's vitally important during these challenging times that we get people indoors. This isn't the first time this has happened. Governments have had to go in and purchase buildings, and we do verify through independent bodies to ensure that whatever purchase prices are being used for BC Housing meet what the market is at.
Leader of the Fourth Party Supplemental.
Mr. Speaker, it's interesting, though, that it's the same individuals that are involved in this and making these significant profits. But you know what, Mr. Speaker? It doesn't end there. There's another purchase in Prince George called the Lotus Hotel, which was purchased for $700,000, and 18 months later was flipped to BC Housing for $2 million, another quick 300% profit in 18 months. Mr. Speaker, not only did this hotel that was purchased need have to be renovated because it wasn't suited, but BC Housing was actually renting this building. They could have just bought it before these people that did the flip bought it. At that time, it was sold for $566,000. So we've got three hotels in Prince George, all with the same individuals involved, all with massive profits, for hotels that also needed to be renovated afterwards. It's not like there was a lot of investment done in between. Mr. Speaker, this trend is very disturbing, to see that these kind of trades are being made, that these individuals, whether having inside information or whatever it may have been, have been able to make significant profits on these housing projects at the expense of the taxpayers of British Columbia. Once again, through you, Mr. Speaker, to the Premier, will you commit to a forensic audit of BC housing to put to rest once and for all of these sort of concerns and issues to make sure taxpayers' monies are being spent appropriately?
Minister of Housing.
Thank you, Chair. And as I said earlier to the member, the procedures that are in place for BC Housing are similar to the procedures that were in place when he was a member of the BC Liberal Party. There are independent checks done by third parties that come in and assess the purchase value. Now, it's hard to understand if the member is suggesting whether we should buy hotels early or whether we should buy them late. But what's most important, I think, for any community that's struggling with people that are in encampments or homeless is getting housing options available right away. It takes time to get communities to agree to build housing. It takes time for that housing to be built. And when you have a challenging situation, you've got to act quick. That previous government, when the member was part of the BC Liberal government, they did the same thing, which is good. It should be commended, where they stepped in and moved people in to hotels, acquired buildings to move people in. And we have to do the same when issues like this arise. And so I appreciate the member's interest in wanting to ensure people that are vulnerable get housing. That's what we're going to continue to focus on the side of the House.
Member for Parkville-Qualicum.
There are nearly 12,000 people in Oceanside on a wait list for a family doctor, a wait list that is 3 years long. In a community with more seniors than any other community in this country, that means that people are waiting longer than they should for access to cancer tests, they're waiting for hip and knee referrals, and they're waiting to get access to the health care they deserve, the health care that they paid for their whole lives. Island Health has been renting a vacant space in a rural part of our community for more than 2 years with the promise to build a new clinic. The space doesn't meet the zoning, and it is currently ballooned to nearly $2 million. But we're still, we have two family doctors that want to work with Island Health to work out of this clinic, but Island Health has refused to adapt their plans to get these doctors into this facility. They are refusing two doctors to come to our community. They are refusing 3,000 patients to get connected with primary care. Question through the Minister of Health, why is there no one working at a local level to connect existing doctors, the Division of Family Practice, and Island Health to connect people with primary care?
Minister of Health.
Thank you, Honourable Speaker. Over the past number of years, we've made significant changes to improve access to family doctors. We signed with our family doctors and developed with the doctors of BC a new payment model that has seen an unprecedented increase in the number of family doctors, 21% across Vancouver Island. But that's not all. We have developed across Vancouver Island, across BC primary care networks. And the member says they should be developed locally. They're developed locally. They're funded by the province, permanent funding, which has never happened before. The primary care network in his region and the primary care networks across BC are developed locally, they invest in team-based care, and currently across British Columbia, 1,800 FTEs work in primary care networks, part of which are urgent and primary care centers. So we work, as he well knows, with doctors and nurse practitioners and healthcare professionals and communities everywhere to establish community health centers in communities across BC, from Rutland, Honourable Speaker, to Lake Country, to Souk, to Vancouver, to Surrey, and we're going to continue to do that work.
Member supplemental.
Thank you, Speaker. The Minister mentions the primary care network. The Executive Director of a primary care network just quit. All of the admin staff of our primary care network just quit. These are people that want to get things done, but government keeps getting in the way. The red tape and the gatekeeping is keeping patients from having access to health care. My office is working with advocates and a local nonprofit to get a community-led clinic going. And through this process, we have met six foreign-trained doctors in our community that are trying to get their credentials recognized. Doctors with years of experience that are getting stuck in processes, that other provinces have found the way to get doctors through. Nova Scotia has shown leadership. Why is it in the province of British Columbia that government is in court right now fighting to prevent foreign-trained doctors having access to residency spaces at UBC?
Minister of Health.
Honourable Speaker, what have we done? We've increased the number of spaces at UBC by 128. 128, that was work done by the Ministry of Health and the Ministry of Post-Secondary Education. We're adding a new medical school at SFU. Last year was a record year because of changes we made in foreign-trained doctors and foreign-trained nurses coming to British Columbia. We've added, across BC, 78 primary care networks, all developed locally. 34 urgent and primary care centres, one that we opened last week in Mission, providing care for people in Mission. And on Vancouver Island, you see the effect of this, 21% more doctors. There is not a health authority in Canada that saw the increase in longitudinal family practice doctors that we've seen on Vancouver Island. And we're going to continue this effort with action after action after action.
Member for Kamloops North Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Well, BC United fully supports local news and the critical role that they play in informing communities, especially in a time of emergency. This premier, however, decided to sell out the local news industry to Facebook in a backroom deal in exchange for government advertising and a promise by Facebook to amplify NDP propaganda conveniently in the months leading up to the provincial election. Now, Mr. Speaker, this has real-world implications when right now we're having government news releases going out promoting the evacuation efforts, conveniently ignoring those same people who are now being evicted out of the hotels they were placed in. That is the critical connection that local news plays, Mr. Speaker. Why did the Premier abandon his promise to support local news, not only to prioritize the NDP propaganda, but right before an election?
Hear, hear. Attorney General.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Nothing could be farther from the truth to what the member just said. Government that's taking unprecedented action for people of this province, including at their highest time of need. That table that's been set by really big social media players is unprecedented in Canada and North America to get them to take real action to protect British Columbians. We're doing that for youth that are being exploited online by predators. We're protecting them more. We're doing that for people that are facing really stressful wildfire situations. When they need information, the Premier's been clear on this. We expect those platforms to deliver that information straight from the Ministry. And we're going to continue to do that work, Mr. Speaker, and we're very proud of it.
Member for Peace River North.
Yeah, thanks, Honourable Speaker. Well, there has been rain in the Northeast, and it has helped the forest fire situation. Fort Nelson is still under immediate threat. The Parker Lake fire, now the Patrick Creek fire, which have both grown into monsters. I witnessed firsthand, I was lucky enough to work in the reception center in Fort St. John and seeing the faces of people coming through. Some people thinking it might be the last time they see their house. But you know, Honorable Speaker, people are angry. Residents in my community are furious at this government and their inaction on failing to deploy all available equipment that is available in that community. Since this weekend and even up to today, Honorable Speaker, I've heard directly from many local contractors that have water trucks sitting, bulldozers, excavators sitting, while the fire is on the edge of that community. When will the Premier finally mobilize every available resource and let the community help fight its fire?
Minister of Emergency Management.
Thank you, Honourable Speaker. And I want to thank the member across the way for his work as a local MLA during this time of crisis. I've appreciated the constant connections, the communication about challenges being faced on the ground so that we can mobilize and address them as quickly as possible. When homes are under threat of fire, as they are in Fort Nelson and the surrounding areas, it is absolutely understandable that people and businesses want to help. wildland wildfires, the wildland firefighters at the BC Wildfire Service, they do work very closely with contractors, including local businesses, forestry industry, local governments, First Nations, and more. We do have many contractors working to help keep Fort Nelson safe. In fact, the 18 pieces of heavy equipment that have been hired are from local companies, and they are supporting response in Fort Nelson right now. There are many local resources being utilized, and I recognize that there are more, and we are always in active discussions with additional contractors who are capable of providing that. I encourage any individuals with heavy equipment who would like to support that wildfire response to register through the BC Wildfire Service. Those conversations are constantly happening.
Member for Kootenay East.
Speaker, well, it's another tragic and sad day here at the Legislature. We heard today already about the tragic preventable death of Sydney, an 18-year-old at the University of Victoria. Another devastating tragedy has unfolded in Cranbrook, where a 13-year-old girl has died from an overdose. Several weeks ago, the young girl overdosed, was taken to the hospital, and released from the emergency room, only to have fatally overdosed 5 days later. She was described as a happy, sweet kid full of love, but she was failed by the lack of treatment options, and she was failed by the lack of legal tools to provide her secure, mandatory care. How many more lives will be lost before the Premier commits to a safe care legislation to prevent more families from suffering such unbearable loss?
For mental health and addictions.
Thank you very much, Honourable Speaker, and thanks to the member for raising this tragic circumstance. And our hearts, of course, on behalf of everyone in this house, go out to the family and the circle of that youth's of that youth. We are continuing to work with our health authorities, with our partners through our school system, to build out the supports that we know youth need to have access to. In order to support them dealing with mental health challenges. We know that that the situation for youth has worsened since the pandemic, and that's why we are working so diligently and so hard with our healthcare through our healthcare system and with education in order to build out those supports. We will certainly understand more in the coming weeks about this particular situation so that we can understand what happened and ensure that this again does not happen to another youth. Thank you, Honourable Speaker.
The bell ends the question period.